It's time for a WeChat workout. WeChat. Go to the Cliff Central account. Tap connect. Then message to show. Stay informed and up to date. It's the Dave Maverick Show. Tuesdays, 1 to 2 p.m. on cliffcentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're tuned into the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. You are now tuned into the non-youth show, which means we will be discussing everything except youth. So we're having all this Youth Day stuff shoved down our throats. And as important as it is, somebody's got to do the hard work. What about the other stuff going on in the world, eh? So that's us. We will be talking especially around the AU summit and a lot of some of the controversy that's come out of that. And also especially what's behind the controversy. What are we not getting because of all the noise and chatter that sometimes makes headlines. But what about the important stuff behind that? I'm joined in studio by Daily Maverick senior Africa reporter Simon Allison. Simon, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Kingsley. Afternoon.
Afternoon.
Happy Youth Day.
Do you say Happy Youth Day?
No. Does anyone?
I don't know if that's a thing. I think we commemorate it with respect. I don't know.
Like a moment of silence.
I don't know. People should tweet us. People, please tweet us. What do you say on Youth Day? In the morning when you wake up, you're like, I don't know. Okay. After the break, I'll come back with an answer for that. But this is the non-Youth Day show, so we're not talking about that. We will be talking especially about the AU summit, like I said. Now, Simon, you've been covering this.
I have been covering this. Okay. And let me just say a very large thank you to Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir, who rescued us journalists from a very, very boring few days.
Man, I was on Twitter and I kept seeing Bashir. And I'm just like, what on earth? Like, what has happened in Santon? So I want you just to give us like a play-by-play. Okay, let's. How do we start with context? So was Bashir publicly invited? Did we all know that he was coming?
We knew nothing.
Okay.
The first thing I want to say is credit to the South African government. They do not have a very good track record of keeping secrets, and yet somehow they kept this one.
Okay.
And it's actually given all us journalists a bit of existential angst.
Okay.
Because for once, the government really has got one up on us. We have been asking about this for months.
Okay.
You know, as soon as it was announced that South Africa would be hosting the AU summit. Now, this happens with every AU summit.
Okay.
You know? Every AU summit that's not in Addis Ababa, the first question is Bashir going to be allowed to attend?
Okay.
A couple of years ago, the AU summit was meant to be in Malawi, and Malawi said, look, you can't come, dude. We're not going to let you in. And they had to move the entire AU summit.
So there is precedent of him not being allowed, and there's precedent of the AU saying, we're not going to have it unless
you
come.
There are other African countries that have said, no, you're not coming. Botswana, I think, is one of them. Botswana always seemed to be on the right side of these issues.
We don't care, man.
Remarkably progressive foreign policy for such a tiny
country. So the AU has moved the summit before to make sure that Bashir can attend.
Yes.
Okay. That's
it's big. Okay. It's a big deal. And I mean, look, let's think about it from a less hysterical perspective.
Yep.
Why would we want Bashir to come to these summits? In theory, because these summits are where things get solved. They're where discussions are made, they're where decisions are taken. Sudan is always on the agenda somewhere or another because it's always in trouble. You know, there is always stuff going on in Sudan. At the moment, there's a, you know, forget about South Sudan.
Mm.
There's a low-level civil war going on between the government and the rebels in the south of the country, near the South Sudanese border, with horrendous humanitarian consequences and a huge loss of civilian life. So this is going on as we speak. I mean, Daily Maverick's about to publish a story tomorrow from a partner organization called Nuba Reports.
Mm.
And they're reporting on this conflict in Sudan. And what they're saying is, you know, while Bashir was being, the red carpet was being rolled out here, in Sudan itself, they were dropping cluster bombs on villages and towns in the rebel-held areas. And now cluster bombs are horrendous things. I don't know if you know much about them, but they're basically, they're not just one bomb. They're a bunch of little bomblets, they're called. And they just get dropped and they spread out. And so instead of, you know, one bomb
one
dropping, you've got these like dozens
into,
of little bombs dropping. Sometimes they don't go off, which actually is what happened a couple of weeks ago. And now in this town where this cluster bomb dropped, it didn't actually explode, But now there are all these like tiny landmines around the town, this unexploded ordnance that might explode at any time.
You've got kids going around and walking.
Exactly. And so, I mean, what this article was saying was you know, yes, Bashir has done all this bad stuff in Darfur. We're trying to pin him for that. But in all that, we've kind of lost that he's still doing it. It's not just historical crime.
Like he did this bad thing once upon a time.
Yeah, it's not like he's, you know, now he's asked for forgiveness or whatever and he's moved on. He's still doing the same stuff he's always done. But anyway, so that was a long-winded way to say maybe Bashir should be at these summits. Maybe he should be part of the discussions as to how to solve the problem. That is a valid argument. I'm not sure I agree with it. But it is certainly,
that makes sense.
You know, that's
what Sudan is on the agenda, and we genuinely want to solve it. You know, it makes sense to have him there.
Exactly. So there is that. But interestingly, that's not the argument anyone has made.
Okay, so you pointed out a vaguely decent argument that no one's making.
Exactly. I will freely offer my services to the Durko Communications Department at a massive fee. So there is this thing that maybe Bashir should be at the AU summit. Mm. There is also this thing, and this is what South Africa has been saying, that actually AU summits are nothing to do with South Africa. They are continental meetings, and effectively they take place on continental territory. Like, to the extent that one government spokesperson said, you know what, effectively the Sandton Convention Center becomes African Union territory. Like, the same way an embassy becomes territory of that nation. So this is what's happening. So, you know, Bashir wasn't coming to South Africa. He was coming to the African Union, and it's a very different thing. Then the other argument they were making, of course, was, well, he's a head of state, and heads of state have immunity from prosecution. There is precedent for this in international law. However, the Rome Statute, this is the treaty that set up the International Criminal Court. This is the treaty that South Africa signed. This is the treaty that South Africa normalized in our own domestic law. What that means is we've taken the terms of that treaty
and we've
actually made our own legislation mirroring those terms. So this isn't international law we're talking about. This is a big misconception. This is domestic law that we are talking about. And the domestic law says, you know what? Your obligations to the International Criminal Court trump any of those precedents around immunity. And that's what why the ICC was saying, well, come on, guys. If he's here, you got to arrest him.
Yeah.
Because even if he gets into the Sandton Convention Center, and that's AU territory, our Tambo is not AU territory, Waterkloof Airport is not AU territory, the N1 is not AU territory, as much as they would like to consider it that for these purposes. So I think that the legal argument is flawed. As the judge
the whole idea that
the whole idea of
the Sandton Convention is actually just Africa now, it's not South Africa. It's just like get out of here. Okay. So the judge is bold enough, and the judge is bold enough to be clear and be like,
yeah, the judge
should not leave until we are clear on what.
So two things. One is, these are reasons for optimism. Are you ready?
We never get this. I'm so excited.
The first thing, civil society. Civil society were ready.
Yeah.
Especially the Southern African Litigation Center, backed up by a few other NGOs, with some quite high-level advisors from other lawyers. They were ready for this. The minute, literally within minutes of Bashir's landing being confirmed, they had submitted an application with the High Court in Pretoria. They had all the documents ready, prepared. They were ready to go. And what they were saying was, you got to arrest this guy.
Yeah.
We've got to make sure that the court is saying you arrest this guy. He's not meant to be here. The court looks at it the next day, the next morning, and said, okay, I've got to give the state some time to prepare its arguments. But until they do so, Bashir's not allowed to leave. That was the first thing, which is a pretty common sense judgment. And they postponed the proceedings to the next day. By the time those proceedings were underway on Monday, Bashir was already in the air. So, which is quite interesting, and it's an interesting legal thing. So the government, South African government, didn't wait for Bashir to be. The government didn't wait for the court to issue an arrest warrant for Bashir. So that didn't actually happen until after he was in the air. Which means what they're saying is the only thing that they're in trouble for is contempt of court, which is a much lesser charge than violating an arrest warrant. That's their argument. It was a very clever legal strategy because it just gives them a little bit of room to fudge the PR.
Yeah, because my next question is, what is the role of the SAPS? Because I picture myself and I think of myself. If I'm being charged with something, I can't just go away. Right? I'm not, in my mind, you're not allowed.
Unless you leave from Waterkloof. Yeah. That's what you've been doing wrong all these years.
I could have Waterkloof.
You could have left at any time.
So that's in my mind, in my zero legal knowledge. You can't just leave because there's a pending trial. So what's the role of the SAPS? What's the role of immigration? And like, who's supposed to say no?
No. Well, until the arrest warrant had been issued. So in this weird transitional phase where the court was just like, no, he can't travel. What the court did was the court got a list of every border post in the country and a nominated official at that border post. And the court said that official, and this was nominated by, Home Affairs. This is the guy. So if Bashir leaves from Bait Bridge, I'm going to phone Mr. X.
Yeah, that's the guy.
And he's the guy I'm going to get. Because you've nominated him. If he leaves from Oratumbo, the guy I'm going to get. Now the gray area. I don't think that Waterkloof is an official border post. So I'm not too sure if Waterkloof was nominated in those court documents. That's, you know, it's another loophole. And the interesting thing is Bashir's plane landed in Oratumbo.
Oh, and took off.
It did a little skip without Bashir on board to Waterkloof. And that's where it left from. So it was clearly a way to try and fudge around what.
So potentially there's no one we can call and be like, hey, John.
There's no head that's gone.
John, you were kind of the guy in charge of this whole machine thing.
And I mean, even if a head were to roll, even if there is a nominated official at Waterkloof, I mean, this poor guy, you know.
And we've seen this before. We know how this goes.
You know.
It's going to be the lowest ranking guy at Waterkloof and be like, dude, you're kind of responsible for cutting the keys here. And fetching the milk, why did you let Bashir leave?
And already what we're seeing is that's exactly the route the government's going. Is you see the statement last night that said, the government is launching an investigation into how Omar al-Bashir left the country. I wonder how he did that. And some poor bastard is going to get hung out to dry. Probably, you know, locked up for a year or two or given a massive fine which someone else will pay and then rewarded with a nice ambassadorship to somewhere warm.
You say it like that, I wouldn't mind being that guy. That's
pretty good. It could be worth it.
So it sounds like the SAPS and like immigration, there's some gray areas about where they're supposed to like.
Hold on, I want to talk about SAPS some more because that's really
different.
Interesting.
Okay.
Let's take the scenario further and say an arrest warrant was issued while Bashir was in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What happens then? Who actually goes and
you have to, like, find
arrests him.
Yeah, you have to go for him.
And this is where it gets interesting. And it ties into South Africa's very messy domestic politics.
Okay.
The police.
Yeah.
Do we think the police is a nice, unified, well-led organization at the moment? You know, are they all singing from the same hymn sheet? Very clearly, we know they're not. We know about all the divisions in the police. We know about the divisions between NPA and Scorpions and Hawks and various acronyms.
Because imagine that'd be a high profile, like a high profile, you know, as I said, would actually be.
So who would actually be charged with doing this? There is a unit within SAPS called the Priority Litigation, Priority Crimes Litigation Unit, mm-hmm. PCLU. These are the ones that kind of have the responsibility to go after high-profile criminals. Bashir certainly falls in that category. According to a source we've got in the PCLU, they're desperate to arrest him.
They're just waiting for the order.
They're quite a professional organization.
Okay.
They understand their obligations, and if the warrant had come through, they were going to try their best to actually arrest him. But now, other branches of the police and South Africa's security forces are the ones protecting Bashir in the Sandton Convention Center. So, I mean, if it had
come down to it... Because they're in charge of protecting heads of state.
Exactly. So we could well have had this weird thing where you got one branch of police coming to arrest the guy, another branch of the same police service trying to stop them.
And are they taking orders from the courts or from the executive?
Exactly.
Which is a whole other story altogether.
And now we come to the crux of the issue, which is the separation of powers in South Africa. It's very simple how it works. There's a legislature.
Yeah.
There's a judiciary. There's an executive. None of them have complete power.
Yeah, that's how it works. You can't just decree things and
All of them have some ability to hold each other
accountable.
To account
yeah.
and to sort of lay down the law in their own specific ways. And if the system all works nicely, then no one can get above a station. Now, the system in this case, and I think increasingly in many other cases, has broken down completely. You have, first of all, you have the legislature. Now, the legislature, this is Parliament. Parliament passed an act making the Rome Statute law.
Okay.
So this is Parliament. This isn't the ICC. It isn't the UN. It isn't the Imperial Barons of the West. This is the South African Parliament, which let's not forget is 60-70% ANC.
Elected
by the people. Parliament has said, we believe in this ICC Act. We're going to make it into our own domestic law. We want you to follow those obligations. And that is the order that Parliament has given yeah. to the executive and the judiciary. Okay? Then you've got the judiciary. The judiciary has taken the case of Bashir and said, you know what? He's not allowed to fly until we've dealt with the situation. He's not allowed to go. So you're not allowed to, you know. So you've got two people. When you've got the Parliament through the ICC yeah. Act saying these are your obligations.
They passed that in like not for this. They passed it just on, yeah. on the premise of what the country should
exactly.
be doing on a principle.
Then you've got the judiciary saying, you know what? Yeah. He can't leave the country. That is okay. an order from the judiciary.
Yeah.
Then you've got the executive saying, screw you. We're going to ignore both Parliament and the judiciary. The two of the three pillars of the South African state just washed down the toilet in this particular case. And I think it is symptomatic of a more general problem where the executive branch in this country has far too much power. Because Parliament is such a pliant body, because it is so heavily dominated by the ruling party, it is not really the originator of laws. What happens is the executive wants to do something,
and they
make Parliament do it. And then they carry it out. So that check and balance is doesn't really exist. And then when the executive wants to do something and it doesn't have time to get Parliament's seal of approval, it just does
they
it
just
anyway.
Do it and then later they'll figure it out.
And then we've also seen the gradual degradation of the judiciary. And I don't mean that in terms of the judiciary is getting worse or less fair or less balanced. I think on the whole, they do a pretty good job. I'm saying that their decisions, their orders are being taken much less seriously.
They're seen as recommendations, and we've seen this play out in Kandla and all these other issues.
Exactly.
Where a court says something, and the cell phone jamming, it's the same thing. A court says something, and it's like, okay, we hear you. Thanks for informing us. And
that's what worries me about this Bashir thing, is it really says a lot about where South Africa is as a country right now, and it doesn't say any good things.
I mean, I saw some very strange statement from the ANC. I think it said the ICC is no longer serving the purpose it was set up for. And I think that was their response.
Well, I mean, at this
and
is,
it's,
you know.
Okay. are you seeing everything that's happening right now? And it's this abstract
exactly.
statement of, you know, and I'm hearing a lot of really false comparisons. So some people are just like, oh, what about the clerk? Then you let Bashir go. Some people are like, the ICC only arrests Africans.
Two quick things on that, because we could talk about this for hours. Yeah. It infuriates me. And the reason it infuriates me so much is because people are speaking from a base of almost zero knowledge on the subject. Point number one. Is that, yes, the ICC has disproportionately targeted African figures.
Yeah.
Now, why is that? Is that because they have an agenda against Africa? Bearing in mind that the current ICC prosecutor is herself from the Gambia. Or is it because African countries, overwhelmingly, have referred these cases to the ICC. The Kenya case is a prime example.
Yeah.
Kenya asked the ICC to investigate.
And then we later
why did it do that? Because Kenya doesn't have the capacity to do it themselves.
Yeah, and often most senior person in the country is implicated, it's very difficult to prosecute
exactly.
internally. Yeah.
Exactly. So the fact is, the reason so many Africans have been indicted by the ICC is because Africa is the only continent that is actually using the court effectively. We are referring, we are asking for investigations to be opened, and we are getting results in the form of people being prosecuted and people being investigated. This is what the court was for. It's not Africa's fault that no other regions of the world are using it as effectively as we are, and yet what our politicians are doing is twisting this into this narrative of Africans being victimized and persecuted, and you know, it plays into colonialism, it plays into racism, and it's easy politics for it's easy populist politics for anyone who wants to avoid the scrutiny of the ICC either now or in the future.
And it's being brought up by the same people who are part of getting their countries to be signatories to making this thing real.
Exactly.
Until it's your turn to go to the ICC and it's like, guys, we must boycott. I mean, I remember Kenyatta had a whole thing with the whole country and lobbying people to go against the ICC. Of course, Botswana said no, because Botswana just do whatever they want.
We love Botswana.
But it's almost until it's your turn. You pro things until it's your turn to go and answer it. It's like this.
And then it's like, oh no, this no longer applies to me. But the other thing that frustrates me is that, yes, I agree the ICC should do more.
Yeah.
You know, I'd love it if the ICC were to open an investigation into Syria or Israel-Palestine, etc., etc. And I think that one day it will get there. But that because it's not doing as much as it can now, doesn't mean we should just throw away everything that it is doing. You know, just because it's not getting one war criminal doesn't mean we should ignore the case it's bringing against the other war criminal. You know, if we have a chance to get one war criminal or no war criminals, I'm going to take the one if I can get it. So it's just that the whole thing is it's a very emotive argument. I think people get very riled up about it. Because of the whole colonial and racial overtones. And I got to say, I think President Kenyatta has a lot to answer for.
So you think a lot of this can actually be drawn back to his...
A huge amount. I mean, I saw Kenyan officials wandering around Sandton Convention Center with little Kenyan government leaflets explaining how diplomatic immunity for presidents works. They clearly had come in prepared for exactly what they were doing. It cannot be disassociated from the, you know, just to fill you in if you're not sure on the background. What happened after Uhuru Kenyatta and William Ruto were charged by the ICC is, first of all, they got themselves elected as president and deputy president of the Great Republic of Kenya. And then second of all, they waged a very bitter backroom campaign in the halls of power on the continent to discredit the ICC at every opportunity, and it has been enormously effective. So effective that at one extraordinary summit, the AU actually issued a statement saying, you know what, we don't believe the ICC is fair anymore. It's quite amazing. And South Africa has been the key opponent in that war. So that you've got Kenya on one side being like, no, the ICC is bad. You've got South Africa on the other side being like, no, we've signed these are our international obligations.
Yeah, yeah.
We're going to uphold them. We believe in international justice. That has been the case until now. By allowing Bashir in, what South Africa has said is that we are giving up on our position of supporting international justice, and we are getting into bed with Bashir, Kenyatta, Museveni, a few others who really are anti what the ICC is doing. So a lot of it has to do with African superpower politics, I think. And I guess, I don't know, maybe South Africa just finally realized that it couldn't do it alone, or no longer wanted to do it alone. With Botswana, of course.
Botswana's just sitting there like, guys, this is pretty clear. I mean, for me, this just brings up this interesting relationship between the regional powers, the AU, and the ICC. And this odd, I mean, because you want the AU to be policing people, but at the same time, the AU is made up of members, and its members all start to change their mind, especially its powerful members. Then that's done, isn't it? Then we've all changed our minds, I guess, and then.
There's something I learned this week about the African Union, and it's taken me a good 3 or 4 years to learn it. So I want to share it with you and remember it. When people talk about the African Union, the African Union has done this. The African Union hasn't done this. They, you know, the African Union is failing the continent, etc.
That comes up a lot on here.
It does come up a lot. There's not really such a thing as the African Union. that has one position, one identity, one mandate. I find it more helpful, and this is what I learned, it's far more helpful to think of it as two separate bodies. So under this AU, you've got the African Union Commission. These are the people that are actually supposed to implement any decisions of the AU. These are the ones that are at Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma is chairing. So there's her, there's various commissioners for peace, trade, security. They're full-time employed by the AU, and they work to try and implement any decisions. Then you've got the AU General Assembly. That is where the heads of state meet twice a year to come to their decisions. And subsidiary to that, you've got various councils like the Peace and Security Council. There's an Economic and Trade Council, I think. But those are, you know, so there's the two sort of separate arenas. One is almost like the civil service, and one is the political agenda. And they can be very different things. And so when we're talking about what the AU is doing, and I speak to the commissioners, I get an amazing sense that, you know, this organization operating on a shoestring budget is actually doing some quite fantastic work, especially on stuff like trade negotiations and regional integration and conflict management. You know, yes, they could do more, of course, but the AU is there. They are mediating. They are sending in observers, etc., etc. They're doing as much as they can with what they have. Then on the other side, you've got the political side of things. Now, the assembly is a representative body. So that's 54 votes. Each country has an equal vote. Now, it's interesting this, because you've got Lesotho that has an equal vote to Nigeria. Is that fair? Is that how we should be making
numbers,
decisions
before you
on
even
the
get to
just
regional power, just on numbers. Yeah.
And the way the African Union has always been structured, almost all African politics goes like this, is about consensus. So it's not about a majority. You can't just get a majority and get the decision made. It needs to have consensus. Everyone has to agree. So all it takes is one dictator to say, you know what, I don't want to condemn Burundi's president for his third term because I'm sitting here in my fifth term, so we're not going to do it. So that means that the African Union, in terms of political action, often has its hands tied behind its back. But that doesn't mean that the Commission can't do very important work as well. And that's one of the things that about the summit was the Bashir nonsense. And it was very typical. You know, all anyone will remember about the summit is the Bashir thing, which is kind of a red herring because Bashir wasn't on the agenda. Sudan wasn't really high on the agenda. The crimes we're talking about happened 10 years ago. It's all kind of
nothing
marginal.
Really happened. He came and he left.
He came and left. You know,
the situation is exactly the same.
Exactly.
As it
and
was
in terms
before.
Of the yeah. business of the actual summit itself, yeah. he was a non-entity. So he was not important.
He took a picture and that
exactly.
was about it.
So, you know, but again, it's this big political decision took the focus completely away from the work the African Union was doing. And the one I want to highlight especially is the signing last week of the tripartite free trade area.
Now, this is something, you know, I'm curious about because it's actually confused me. It sounded like just merging all the regional blocks and SADC and the East Africa and just bringing it all together and saying it's one block and free trade for all. And I'm sure that's a terrible simplification of the issue. So please.
Not really. Okay. It's pretty much where it is. So you got these three different free trade areas.
Yeah.
Southern African Development Community, East African Community, and COMESA, which is the community of Eastern Southern African states, I think. But COMESA is quite big. It goes all the way up to North Africa, includes Libya and Egypt. So effectively now, what they've done is they've looked at this and said, well, there are three free trade areas. Why don't we just connect them? And then we have one massive free trade area. So what they're going to do is, well, they have done exactly that. They've said that when the stuff is all implemented, and it'll still take a bit of time to happen, basically a similar regime is going to apply from Cape Town all the way up to Cairo. And you can actually go through the whole continent through the new tripartite free trade area. So it's going to drop. So part one is to drop tariffs. This is huge. Think about that. You can get your goods all the way to Cairo from here without paying without any duties paying at the borders.
I mean, so it's literally just transporting it and that's
it. It's just transporting it. That's the first one. The second thing they're going to do, because of course it's not just about actual tariffs, is it? It's about what hinders trade is also infrastructure, you know, the roads and
how
water
do you actually
posts
get it,
and the, you know.
Safely and quickly.
And then non-trade barriers, things like corruption, how many bribes you have to pay at each border. So all these add ups. But stage one is to drop the tariffs. Fantastic. Stage two is then to put serious money into building roads and bridges and, you know, and it's kind of boring stuff. People, it's not like this grand, you know, you build one dam and you're going to solve energy
that's
in
what
Africa
I
do. Forever.
It's going to solve everything.
You know, it's little piecemeal stuff. And one very tiny example is that, you know, the road, I spend a lot of time in Zambia and there's a road between Mfue, which is the village where I go to often, and Chipata, which is the nearest big town. Now, it used to be that road was in a terrible state, and it used to take something like 3 hours to get your goods across. In the rainy season, it was 6 or 7 hours, if it was possible, it was often not possible. Now they've built a road. You know, it's not a very glamorous road. It's just a basic road with two lanes, and that trip now takes an hour. You know, what savings does that give the people who operate between Mfui and Chipata? Huge savings in time, in energy, in petrol, in just the, you know, ability to plan, because they know that
they know how long it's going to take. That's a big one.
All that, and what that's going to do is make trade between those two places incredibly much more lucrative and so much easier.
So it's small tweaks like that across the continent.
But now imagine we get a bunch of those tiny little tweaks going all the way up. If you save 2 hours here, 5 hours there, 7 hours there, another 2 hours there. I mean, you could cut journey times dramatically, very easily, I think. So that's this part too, is fixing some of the infrastructure, and people like the African Development Bank are going to be quite heavily involved in that, I think, providing the funding necessary to make it happen. The third thing is then to work on the non-tariff barriers. I think that is a much more difficult project because, you know, we've been trying to root out corruption on this continent for a very long time, and it's been difficult. But having said that, you know, the more trade increases, the more multinationals get involved, the harder it is going to be to pay a bribe. You know, if you are, say, a big company like Unilever or Coca-Cola, and you want to bring your truck across the border, you can't pay a bribe because that's, you know, your company is too big to let that happen. Because it's too bad for your reputation, you know. So the more serious whereas if you're a small little company, you just need to get to the, you're going to pay the bribe, aren't you? So the more big companies that are involved that can afford to take a stand against sort of petty corruption, that is also going to dissipate. And of course, they're going to be attracted by the better roads and the non-tariffs. So it's all a really encouraging step. Even more encouraging is that this is just the first step, actually. The tripartite free trade area is the prelude to something called the Continental Free Trade Area. This is going to link basically the whole of Africa.
It's
going to be one big free trade area, which in terms of bringing up overall development on the continent, bringing up investments in the continent, bringing up intra-African trade, I think stands at something like 7% of Africa's total trade volumes. In Europe, that figure is 60%. So Europe mostly trades with each other. Africa trades with other people. And that's crazy because that means what we're trading is resources, essentially. We're sending them off. We're not doing things like biscuits and hardware and, you know, all those little things that we're importing.
We all use and consume abroad. But now we're importing.
Exactly. So it all should be a good idea. Okay. But these negotiations are going to be really interesting because not everyone wins in the short term. South Africa, Nigeria, Kenya, Ethiopia, they're loving this idea because they've got established markets, they've got companies that are just waiting to go into these
markets. A lot of these guys have coastlines and they benefit so much more than some of the other smaller guys
in Burundi. They're waiting for those borders to open and they're going to rush in there and they're going to dominate the market. which is good for the overall
continental prosperity. However.
What does that mean for your little countries that suddenly they have no protection? That border that was their protection, that allowed them to develop their own markets, now that border goes and they're going to lose out quite big time. So they're going to have to think of some compensation scheme, which they are doing. So something like, you know, of taxing some of the trades so that it goes back into redressing the balance between the countries.
I mean, that's really clever. And that was my first sort of thought when you said we're going to make one big free trade area. It's just, how does it balance for the smaller guys? Anyway, if you're just tuning in, this is the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. We're just about to go into a short break and we'll be right back talking about what we're missing at the AU conference with all the Bashir chaos. See you soon.
Get a taste of the Republic of Extra Cold at the Embassy event on the 27th of June at Nasrec, Johannesburg. This epic event will raise the flag for extraordinary experiences with Boys and Bucks, Casper Nyovest, and many more. With only 4,000 tickets on offer, get yours now for only 200 Rand at CompuTicket or visit castlelight.co.za for more information on the coolest event this winter. Unlock Extra Cold Refreshment. Enjoy responsibly. Not for sale to persons under the age of 18. Cliff Central.
Good afternoon. You're tuned into the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. I'm joined in studio by Simon Allison, and we're talking all things Africa Summit. With all the chaos about Sudanese president wanted at the ICC, Omar al-Bashir, we're missing a lot of good work being done. And Simon is talking us through some of those. So we talked a bit about the free trade agreement that they're planning. And it sounds massive. It sounds like a continental sort of free trade plan that in principle at least sounds like it could really revolutionize trade and investment and inequality across the continent. I mean, is there anything more you think we need to know about that? We've talked about the little changes that need to happen. So things on roads and bridges and border posts, things like rooting out corruption, the balance of trying to make sure some of the poorer countries or lesser developed countries rather are benefiting from that. I mean, is there anything more you think we need to keep in mind on the free trade area?
No, I think that's about it. Okay. We're just going to keep an eye out. They're hoping to have this in place, working by 2017.
Well, that's really soon. I thought it would be one of those random years, like 2087 in our lifetime. So it sounds like there's real determination to get this done in the short term.
I think it is. And it's one of those, you know, it's not sexy, trade and, you know, tariffs and this kind of thing. But these are the kind of agreements that are going to make this continent grow. These are the kind of agreements that are going to bring peace and security to the continent. Because the more we trade with each other, the more income we bring in, the more developed we become, the less likely it is that we're going to be fighting
our fortunes are just more and more ingrained
more and more
to each
in,
other.
Interlinked, so it's a really positive trajectory. So, you know, yes, the AU doesn't do all it can in certain issues and doesn't always say the right things, but it is doing really important stuff like this, which is going to have massive long-term implications.
Absolutely. I mean, another thing I've been curious about is the sort of theme for this summit has been the year of women empowerment and development towards Africa's agenda in 2063. Oh, that's great. We've got the random year. And I'm just wondering how perhaps a bit cynical, but how high up the agenda is the empowerment of women? Is it just a sort of nice theme, or are you seeing real determination to have this as front and center on what's being discussed during the summit?
It's an interesting question. And to be honest, I'm not entirely sure. They spoke about it a lot. Every speech mentioned it. Robert Mugabe, in his keynote address at the opening, spoke at length talking about... He challenged... Any man in this room, put your hand up if you were not born of a woman. And the audience thought that was very amusing. Okay. Now, of course, this is all just lip service. So what actual actions are they
taking?
And that I'm less clear about. I haven't seen much in the way of actual substantive decisions coming out of the summit. One thing I did notice, though, is that all of the commissioners, so the AU Commission, they've got this rule that 50% of the commissioners have to be female.
50, okay.
And it was quite controversial at the time, but they pushed through with it and they've done it. And they, you know, they have managed to achieve that, which means that in the higher echelons of the African Union, in the corridors of power, are these amazing, talented, intelligent women making decisions, influencing decisions, and riding point on a lot of the big developments that the continent is doing. So I'm really encouraged by that. Like the commissioner who is leading the Continental Free Trade Area, you know, the push for that. She's quite young, energetic, vibrant, and I think she's going to do a really good job in pulling off delicate negotiations.
I mean, I quite like that, rather than these old men sort of sitting around being like, how do we empower these women? You know, like, involve them in the decision making, exactly. And people will decide for themselves
actually,
what they need.
Actually empower them rather than talking about empowering
about how,
them.
But how could we do this? Okay, so that's, I mean, that's nice to hear. So maybe not the kind of action steps you want to see, but you are seeing more inclusion at the very least.
Absolutely. And it's definitely something that is being factored in at most levels, I think.
Okay, so maybe before 2063 we'll see something happen. Now, Simon, we've just got a few minutes left, and I wanted just to talk about your next adventure. You're going to be in Addis for a few months, hey?
I leave tomorrow.
Okay, you just can't get enough of the AU. When they move, you just want to move with them.
By the end of this, I'm going to be the AU whisperer.
Oh, for sure, man. You'll just be like, don't quote me, but something big's going down. I mean, what's going on for 3 months? That sounds like a hell of a long time to be covering this.
So I'm sort of wearing two hats as of a week ago. I'm still doing my thing with the Daily Maverick. That's front and center. But I'm also helping out the Institute for Security Studies.
Okay.
I think they're probably the biggest think tank in Africa. They've got offices in 4 or 5 African countries, including one in Addis. And they run this thing called the Peace and Security Council Report. So that's the Peace and Security Council of the African Union.
Yeah.
They meet once or twice a month. They make the big decisions on like Burundi and South Sudan and Somalia, all the conflict stuff. And this report just basically looks at what they're doing, reports on what they're doing, tries to get inside the decisions, who's saying what, who's for things, who's against things, just to try and get a bit better understanding of how the politics actually happens. So they've asked me to help them out for a few months with that. The guy that they had lined up was called away to be the UN envoy for South Sudan or something fancy like that. So they were in a bit of a gap, and I'm filling it. I'm very excited because it's going to get me up close and personal with the African Union, with the people who make the decisions. It's definitely going to help the rest of my Africa reporting. So it's very complimentary.
I mean, how do you feel about being in Addis? I mean, I know you've been there before. You probably have a general idea of how things work there. But being a journalist in Addis for this long, and issues of media freedom and press freedom.
You know,
Ethiopia.
I love Addis. I love Ethiopia. It is a wonderful country, steeped in history and culture.
Yeah.
It has fantastic food. The people, everyone's friendly. It's beautiful. There's hills. Everyone goes running. It's just a nice life.
It's starting to sound like you're never coming back.
That's what my wife's worried about. But there's no denying that being a journalist in Ethiopia is difficult. Working for an NGO in Ethiopia is difficult. The government, and I have been careful to praise the government in the past because it is doing a pretty good job on development and delivering socioeconomic rights to portions of its people. But on civil rights, things like freedom of political expression and freedom of media, it's got a pretty poor record. I don't know what it's going to be like to work there as a journalist. I don't know how closely what I say will be monitored. I don't know how much danger I will be putting potential interviewees in if I go and speak to them. A lot of that I'm going to learn from other journalists who are there and who have worked there in the past, because it's the last thing in the world I want to do is go in there like a bull in a china shop and cause damage to anybody. So it's going to be a very interesting learning experience. I've always had the privilege of working in a country where my right to expression is pretty fundamental and it's guaranteed, and I've never felt that there's anything I can't say. But Ethiopia is different, and managing that's going to be interesting.
I mean, yeah, I was thinking of this, sorry, slight tangent. I saw a Zapiro cartoon, and they had this thing of Jacob Zuma, and he's got three parts in his head. It's like next wife and Kandla stay out of jail or something like that, which is, it gives you a giggle. But I just stopped and I thought, in South Africa, you can print that in the newspaper and not fear for your life. And I think it's easy to forget that there is a lot of places you just can't do that. You can't insult the ruling party. You can't insult the president. And before you get to insult, you can't expose the details of what they're doing. even if it's not a grand conspiracy. You can't say this place has no road and no hospital and it's supposed to and it's their fault. You can't say that. So, you know, we'll be interesting to see how things go for you. And I don't mean to forebode things. I just think it's easy to forget when we're here in Joburg, we're here in South Africa, and it is
easy. It's very easy. And, you know, you almost tend to sort of, definitely been guilty of this, of almost brushing aside those civil rights because you're like, well, you know, if a government is delivering food and energy and health and that kind of thing, then surely that's more important than the others. But
it'll follow. There's a common assumption that it follows. If you get the economic and financially crucial, right, sooner or later there'll be freedom of speech.
But it's one of those things that's really easy for me to say, sitting in my position of absolute freedom of speech, which I enjoy here. So I'm very interested to see what it's actually going to be like to work in those kinds of conditions, and how journalists get around them, because journalists always do get around them.
I don't know.
You know, there was people often, there's this phrase Kremlinology, which they often use to talk about dissecting news from authoritarian regimes. It was first about Russia during the Cold War. It's often used in North Korea. People use it about Eritrea and Rwanda, and it's basically, you know, if a state newspaper prints that, you know, the prime minister went to visit this person, if you are in tune with how everything works, you know who that person is, and you know that visit signals a change in the political winds.
So you know what's really going on.
So you know what's really going on. You know, so there's almost a, you know, all journalists, I think, even if they are working under really strict conditions, find ways to provide little clues to their readers so that they actually know what's going on.
So you're going to be an expert in criminology in a couple of months. You'd be like, if you read the headline backwards, what you really see. No, man, but I mean, we're definitely going to miss you here on the show, and we really hope to be able to call you in once or twice to give us a scoop of what's going on in the EAC.
Absolutely. If I don't say anything, you'll know.
That's a message too. That's part of our criminology. If you can't call Simon, now you know how it's going. Anyway, unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for tuning into the Daily Maverick Show. Please, please enjoy the rest of your youth day. We'll be back next week as usual. Please download the podcast, share it with your friends, and subscribe on iTunes. We will see you next week. CliffCentral.com.